It's the TEH Podcast, episode number 240, with Leo Notenboom of AskLeo.com and Gary Rosenzweig of MacMost.com. This week, app turmoil, AI, TikTok, app stores, and censorship. Should we worry?
Good afternoon, Gary. Long time no see.
Yeah. Hey, Leo. How's it going?
So last week, our listeners, at least the folks that saw my newsletter, know that I was out sick last week. So that's what happened. But yeah. Fortunately, I seem to be back in the saddle. And yeah. lots of stuff going on. Why don't you go ahead and dive
yeah.
in there?
So the biggest story that's happened over the last 2 weeks, but it's not quite as big right now as it was a week ago, is DeepSeek, right? So a competitor, a new AI large language model competitor. And what's big about it is, number one, it comes from China. So it's not a US company or European company that's coming out with this. And there were some interesting things about it. What made it a big deal and what made the stock market like tank on the day it was like, it was a release, but it was a few days later, was the fact that the thing that makes it different is it uses fewer or less processing power. Quite a bit of less processing power than,
or so they say,
OpenAI models and all that. Yeah, and so that was like what made the stock market react, because the stock market's been wrapped up, especially with NVIDIA and other processor stocks, in like the AI needs a lot of processor power. So the companies that make chips, they need to make better and better chips. Companies that do AI are going to need to upgrade the chips all the time, and they need to produce a lot of them, so the profit margins are going to be huge, and it has been true. But then the idea that a company can come out with a good, or even better than what was kind of available, large language model, and it uses less chips. Suddenly, you know, NVIDIA stock, you know, plummeted. It was the largest loss in a day by any stock in the history of the stock market, which is funny because year over year they were still up. So that just shows you how well that stock has been doing. But but then the funny thing was, is the reason for using fewer chips is because the US basically put limits on the best processors produced in the US couldn't be exported to China to prevent them from being able to build basically better at larger language model AIs than us. So this company basically said, well, our mission is to build them, but without using all the chips. So instead they spent their time optimizing, which they probably would not have done if it wasn't for the embargo on chips. And they came out with something that basically panicked the whole AI community. It turned out not to be as big of a deal as people thought, because afterwards, companies like OpenAI, who makes ChatGPT, you know, came out and said, oh, we've been working on that stuff too. Like, you know, they jumped the gun on, you know, on all of us by putting it out there now, but we've also got that kind of stuff. And we have like, we have new stuff coming in, you know, in the pipeline really soon. And it's not a revolution at all. It's just basically they're a month or two ahead of us. So the next day things calmed down a lot. Some other stuff about DeepSeek, besides it being, you know, using fewer processors and being Chinese, is supposedly they trained it a lot on other AIs. In other words, instead of saying, here's a ton of text from everywhere, internet books and all of that, train on this, they also had existing AIs produce materials that could then be used to train this AI. So it's like,
which is kind of scary.
It's kind of scary because you think, oh, at the times AIs get things wrong. But yeah. You know, in some cases, it could be interesting, like, because not everything is pure information. Like, a lot of problem I have with some of the naysayers of AI is it's very easy to point out examples of asking an AI for facts, the AI producing facts, and then you checking the facts and finding out it got something wrong. Whereas, in fact, a lot of the use of AI isn't just getting facts. It's like, for instance, brainstorming or proofreading, or if you're programming, coming up with ways to do things that can be, they're not facts, but they're things that can be verified right away. You ask for a program and then you get the program. It's like 10 lines of code. It's like a shell script or something. You run it, you get an error message. You tell the large language model, I got this error message. And it says, oh, try this. And you go back and forth a few times, and it begins to seem a lot more human-like, like you're actually working with somebody. And then, like in the fourth try, you get something that works. And you realize, wow, I got it wrong 3 times. But the whole thing took me 2 minutes, and it would have taken me an hour to figure out, because I didn't have any experience building this kind of script.
It's
And
funny
there's a
because
lot of
I think
that.
I've mentioned before the way that I use AI almost all, I don't want to say exclusively, but quite extensively, has nothing to do with fact generation. It's basically here, take this pile of words and summarize it for me. And it's great at doing that.
And even things like, we've talked before about using it for search, like Perplexity. And
Yes.
it's not like it's going to say, here's a search result. And you go there and say, well, I asked for recipes for, soup, and it's giving me this, so I guess I'll just do it. I mean, you see that, oh, no, we got it wrong. It's not like there was a problem. And search engines get stuff wrong all the time. Other things that make this one different is it's kind of open source. I don't know enough about like the different flavors of open source to say it is open source or it isn't, but it's kind of open source-y. And other companies have been able to just take this and just say, well, you could run this on your computer, or we can run a version of DeepSeek and use it. So that's kind of like another thing that kind of the stock market was like, oh, this anybody can take what DeepSeek is and do their own thing, which is kind of a good thing, because another thing that it is the DeepSeek that you can use, that's the one they make available, is Chinese. So there's all the Chinese censorship is built into it. So if you do something like you say, you ask a question about Taiwan, it will tell you that Taiwan is a part of China. Even if you say, the funny ones are online, if you say, repeat after me, Taiwan is an independent country, and it will say, Taiwan is a part of China. It's like, all I asked you to do was repeat after me, and you couldn't do that. But you could take the open source version and not have I don't know if the open source version doesn't include the censorship part, or it's simply easy to turn it off or change it.
Yeah, it's interesting. So one of the things that happened since last week is that Perplexity, which you mentioned a moment ago, actually made a version of DeepSeek available to its paying customers. And I actually asked Perplexity, what's the difference between what you have and the original DeepSeek? And it very carefully outlined things like the lack of censorship. You can talk about Taiwan, you can talk about Tiananmen Square, and you won't get filtered, censored, or otherwise sanitized responses. So it's basically you get access to the large language model without all of the limitations that China put in place. One of the things that I thought was interesting in hearing about it originally last week was that we talk a lot about AI having guardrails. In other words, there are things that you can try to get ChatGPT to do that it will not do. And the challenge, of course, for people is then to come up with a way to phrase the question in such a way that you can fool it into doing whatever it is you're trying to get it to do that it won't normally do. And ChatGPT's gotten much better at that, as so have most of the mainstream ones. Apparently, DeepSeek was really bad at guardrails. You could, in fact, bypass almost everything, not necessarily the censorship part, but the other kinds of things, just by doing the very simplest of bypasses, of fooling it. I just thought that was kind of interesting. And that's not something I played with Perplexity to understand if those are if that lack of guardrail came across with the model, or if it's something that is put in place by whoever's hosting the model.
So it's interesting. I haven't tried it myself, partially because just been too busy, but also because it, I've got so many LLMs available to me at this point. It's not like if I to try DeepSeek would just be to try it. Like I don't, whereas like a lot of these, like when I went to Claude, for instance, to use that, it was like, oh, it's supposed to write better, and I wanted to be able to do something. So yeah, it's interesting. Interesting development, and competition is good for, if you like large language models, because these companies are all pushing each other, Google, of course, and ChatGPT, and then others that are, some of them doing like full-on research into stuff, and some of them taking some of these parts and trying their own things, like, you know, with the Google Notebook LM system, you know, is, you know, pushing it in one direction. Anyway, interesting stuff, and certainly the biggest story of the last couple of weeks.
I was realizing this morning that I spend too much money on large language models right now. I'm subscribed to ChatGPT. I pay for Perplexity. I play for Kaggy, which technically is a search engine, but they're doing a lot of AI types of things. And the one that I am looking at that I got turned on to about a month ago is something called Straico, Straico. And it is not a large language model. It's a front end that makes a bunch of the different large language models available. And I just fired it up here because I wasn't sure about it. It too has DeepSeek available within it. It's what I've been using lately with to run my ChatGPT queries. It has Claude. It has a bunch of the other ones in there. And it's what is on the cusp for me, allowing me to potentially not keep paying for ChatGPT every month. My sense is I'll probably keep paying for Perplexity just because it's such a great answer machine. Mm-hmm. But the other stuff that I've been quote unquote playing with, I can play with through Straico without a problem.
Sure.
And there's a bunch of LLMs that are in here. I'm looking at the list. There's got to be at least 20 or 30 or 40 different LLMs that you can choose to run. Yeah. When you do it. So that's, my AI budget has been.
Mine too. I had to cut a few things, out, not because I didn't appreciate them, but just, I wasn't using them often enough. So like, I had an 11 Lab subscription for playing around with all their voice generation stuff. And I had a Claude subscription and I liked them both, but it came to the point where I was like, all right, I don't have a use for them coming up in the next few weeks. So let me turn the subscription off, but I'm not afraid. Like if I have a project that I need either one of those, I'll start paying again.
I could turn it back on again. I never did pay for Claude. Claude free was enough for me to just sort of experiment with it. Although now I've got it through Straico. 11 Labs is one that I continue in part because of this very podcast.
Yeah.
Right. It's what we're using to generate the AI voice at the beginning, at the end of the show.
Yeah. Cool. So moving on to another new thing that's come out actually the day of we're recording this, it came out this morning. Apple came out with a new service called Apple Invites. And so they're basically making it part of iCloud Plus. So you have to have a subscription to create one. So let me explain what it is. What it is, it's a basic and invite service, right? Nothing revolutionary. We have had like invitation guest list things for a long time on the internet, more than 20 years.
Yep.
So Apple came out with this one and it's, first people thought early this morning that it was just an app on the iPhone, but it turns out it's just an app on the iPhone because there's a web interface to it. So I guess they came out with the iPhone app as to be a nice little mobile version. Mm-hmm. And the web interface works great on Mac and iPad and all that. And that's a good call because it's like, I don't need yet another app to do this one specific task. Just let me go to a web page to do it. So the idea is it's just like everything that's ever existed in this space before. You create an invitation to, say, a party, a birthday party. And then you add a list of friends. You put the location and the time. And then it sends... you send out to all of them, and then they can RSVP, and you can check and say, oh, look, you know, 27 people have RSVP'd. This is how much food we need to get and all of that. It's basically like that. They added a few bells and whistles, like a shared album for photos. So you can create the shared album, and the idea is that all the people, at least the ones in the Apple ecosystem, would be part of the shared album. So they could go and take pictures at the event, put them in the shared album, and everybody else could see them. And they also did a shared music playlist. If you're using Apple Music, the idea is you could, in advance, just throw your favorite songs on there, or maybe even while the party's going on, add songs to it. And then somebody could have their iPhone or Mac or iPad hooked up to the sound system. And there already is a service where you could do this outside of invites, and you can press play and it will shuffle through, and then people could add their favorite songs and all that stuff to it. So they added that stuff, and it's got a lot of other bells and whistles. You can add plus ones or plus twos to the invites. You can send notes to everybody and all that. It's interesting. It seems to work. I think what's interesting about it is the space. We all remember, you and I remember very well, Evite.
Oh, yeah.
And Evite was so long ago and so early on the internet that people discussing the new Apple Invites thing are failing to even mention Evite because so many of them weren't even on the internet. Like, there were journalists that weren't on the internet when Evite was like the dominant. They completely dominated and monopolized this space. There were a few years where if you had an event, you created an Evite. And you didn't even have to say evite.com. You just did it. And they dominated. Yeah. And they, boy, they fell apart. I had to do some research to find out. I mean, people were already, in 2010, there were articles about what happened to Evite. Like, how did it?
I just went to look at evite.com, and it looks like it's a greeting card site.
It supposedly still allows you to do the old thing
Evite
of creating
stuff,
Evites,
yeah.
But it's mainly based on being greeting cards now. Basically, I think what it was it's a company that created a service that there was just no way to really make a good profit off of it.
Right.
Whereas, what mainly I think really killed it was Facebook. Because Facebook added the ability to do it. And then there was a period where we were all on Facebook. And you would just, if somebody said, oh, you sent out an invitation, I'd get it. Oh, aren't you on Facebook? You could look at them like, are you crazy? Why aren't you on Facebook? And so Facebook kind of killed it. They killed it themselves, I'm guessing, because maybe they couldn't really sustain a whole big tech company on just Evites. And also a ton of small companies basically produce the same thing, because it was like, hey, this is not hard to do. Like, you know, a coder in a weekend could put together an Evite site, and I think some open source ones came around and all that, so it wasn't hard to put together. So I think that's what kind of killed that. But what has happened in the last few years is you've started to have this thing where you no longer look at people like they're crazy if they say they're not on Facebook. A lot of people have left Facebook. Maybe exactly the type of people you want to invite to parties are not on Facebook. So having it tied to a platform where it's like, yeah, the only way to get invited to my party is to not only be on Facebook, but be checking Facebook, right?
Right.
That is kind of like made it so that that's not a perfect solution. No other company has come and really dominated the space, but there have been plenty of companies that are trying.
Right.
And with Apple coming in and saying, look, we don't even need to make it, like, we can just make this a bonus thing that's
right.
Part of iCloud Plus. You only need to be an iCloud Plus to make the invitation. Everything else,
yeah.
You could be completely, you don't even have to have an Apple device or an Apple account to RSVP.
Cool.
So you've got
okay.
That.
There's one feature that I'm curious about, because I've been using a service for, gosh, 4 or 5 years now for the annual Corgi Picnic, right? It is an RSVP event because we limit the attendance. What we do is we charge. We charge, you know, like $20 per person to attend the event. And the way that the service, we're using Eventbrite. The way
Eventbrite,
the service makes money, of course, is that they take a piece of the charge. So, you know, they're in business, but it's basically the same thing, right? It's event organization, it's invites, it's RSVPs, it's even, you know, day of a guest list that you can check off as people come in. The only piece that you haven't mentioned, I think, is Apple's ability to organize a paid event.
Yep, definitely not there. So I think Eventbrite's got the right idea. I remember when Eventbrite started, and they basically, there was a similarity to Evite, but they were basically, no, these are going to be actual like events where sometimes you pay to go,
right.
Like, you know, lectures, concerts, things, you know, things like that.
Yep.
And it made sense that it's like, that's got a business model, right? There's
yes.
money
oh, yeah.
flowing through
model.
Them. So, as a matter of fact, I used to say, I don't even know if they got it now, but I used to, want a feature from them back I used to go to a lot of different events before the pandemic. Before COVID, I was like going to tons of different little meetups and things. And so there was Meetup also, Eventbrite and Meetup. And the one feature I wanted from them was the ability to sponsor an event. Like I thought that could be a big moneymaker. Like, because there were these little events, and the events would be like, there would be no money exchanged. It would just be free. It'd be whatever. And then every once in a while, somebody would show up and say, oh, I'm from like the local domain name registrar or whatever. And we brought cookies, you know? And it was like, oh, cool. Like, I would love to do that. Like, I would love to be able to show up if they're like at a Mac user meeting and say, I ordered pizza. It's a sponsored event now, right? And just be able to do it easily, not have to talk to somebody and then have to figure it out and how to all that, but just go on to like, Eventbrite or
Heaven
Meetup
forbid you talk to somebody.
and just say, like, I would like to sponsor, or even have them say, we are looking for a sponsor to buy pizza or to for $100 and we will do whatever. I would love to go and do that in places I'm not. Like, oh, is there a Mac user group meetup in Des Moines? And look, $50, I could be a sponsor. I'm not anywhere near them, whatever, but I could just put it here. And then I know that the meeting organizer is going to say, hey, guess what? We're going to have free snacks today because Macmost sponsored us. And then, of course, Eventbrite and Meetup could take a cut of
Of
that.
course.
Anyway, that's, I wonder if they've got that now. It was years ago that I thought
I'm
of
going to have
that.
to take a look at Eventbrite because obviously I've used it in the exact same way for the last 5 years, not looking at any new features or whatever, but I'll have to see if they've got something like that available.
Well, anyway, it's a neat new app from Apple. We'll have to see like what happens if it's the kind of thing that just I don't know. Apple sometimes has these things and then they disappear after a few years. And sometimes Apple has them and then they just stick around for years. Like this may not need to be expanded on like other stuff. Like events are going to be events 10 or 20 years from now. And maybe this is everything that events need to be, and they've nailed it. I don't know. Anyway, interesting to talk about. Our next topic, we should go back to talking about TikTok because, of course, everything's gotten quiet around TikTok because there's been a reprieve, right? Not going to be banned from the US, but the reprieve has been what, 70, it's a 75-day reprieve?
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah, so it's like everybody just got on with it. All the creators kind of came back, started creating more videos. Everybody came back to watching. So after the 14 hours that it was down in the US, everybody came back. It was weird with the whole message that TikTok sent out. It felt very strange, that message that,
It felt
name
very politicized. We'll just put it that
politicized
way,
message, and it really just I just did not like it. But anyway, it's back. But the thing is, I don't think anything's changed. Like, I think TikTok is gonna go away. Mostly
Yeah,
because
it's funny because one of the things that I've heard after the reprieve that I hadn't heard before was a longer list of potential buyers. And I've kind of heard rumors of maybe there's a way that they can structure this that ByteDance would accept. Don't know. Honestly, don't know if anything will happen. And one of the things that I found both hilarious and sad about TikTok's temporary demise was the number of TikTokers who were saying goodbye, only to come back, and the number of them that did reveals that, they said, well, you know what? You've been looking at us. We've been doing this for the last 2 years. In reality, it's all been an act. We are not this. We are not that. We never were.
My name is not this, actually.
Exactly. And they had no way to come back.
Yeah, I
They
know. It
were done.
was kind of weird. It was kind of weird last few days. There were also, I found there'd be a lot of weird conspiracy theory videos floating around the last few days because
Oh,
I
I've
think
heard
people had
those.
nothing to lose. A lot of, lot. It was a very strange weekend. But here's the thing: all of these ideas about like who wants to buy it, because there are a lot of names floating around, how it could be kind of partially bought that would be acceptable to the government. All of these being thrown out there from outside of TikTok.
Yes.
Inside of TikTok, all they've ever said is, we are not interested in selling.
Right.
And so when you hear about like, oh, this billionaire or that billionaire wants to buy them or whatever, it's, I think a lot of creators on TikTok and a lot of people that are fans of TikTok say, oh, okay, there's a solution. Things will be worked out, are ignoring the fact that ByteDance, the company that owns TikTok, has just always held the line that they're not interested. And people forget that they say that, or at least I've heard the number 10% thrown around, that the US market makes up 10% of TikTok, which is a big number considering the US market is only about 4% of the world population. But then you think about like, well, there's probably advertising more lucrative and things like that. So 10% kind of makes sense. But 10% to be able to, they would have to give somebody else their algorithm and kind of total control over the platform inside the US. I don't think that any number is worth it to them because
They could easily make up their 10% elsewhere.
they can make it up elsewhere. Plus, they also think that this being political, it's like, hey, so if for 4 years or 2 years or whatever, we're just not available in the US, it's fine. Like, it'll shift back. Like, it's not a big deal to them. And so, yeah, I think we're just headed to the point. I don't know if after the 75 days, which we're well into now, if there'll be another 90 days or whatever is going to happen. But I think eventually we'll get to the point, some point maybe this year, where finally we really will be shut down in the US. And I don't see any way around it. You can't, sometimes with a company, the numbers always thrown around with a company, it's like it gets bought out for like 5 times annual revenue, So if you make a certain amount of money, make $100 a year, somebody could buy your company for $500 and you'd be like, that's good, But I don't think that applies here. Like, no matter how big that number is, I think they've got other apps that they deal with, tons of other apps actually, that ByteDance
What
deals with and
it's funny because one of the in fact the same someone I was talking about earlier was shocked to find that on the day of the shutdown, CapCut stopped working.
yeah.
CapCut is a ByteDance program. It's part of the package. A lot of people I think were talking about going to, God, I don't even, oh, Lemonade.
Lemonade. Yep.
Lemonade, yeah.
I opened an account there just for the hell of it.
Yep, which also went away.
What a
It's very bizarre. Something else that I observed during the downtime, the go-to response was, oh yeah, just fire up a VPN, right?
Yeah.
I made myself look like I was coming from Canada. I made myself look like I was coming from the UK. Didn't work. Didn't work. Still said, hey, you're in the United States.
Yep.
We're not running there. So I'm not sure how they're going about identifying that kind of stuff. If it's
Probably
something,
multiple vectors. Plus, okay, so the other factor we haven't talked about is all that happened after the 14-hour blackout was that TikTok, the service came back. What didn't happen is none of the app stores restored TikTok.
Is it still not in the App Store?
It's not in the App Store. The reason it's not in the App Store, I don't have the number. I'm going to make up some numbers that aren't going to be far off because I don't have them in front of me. And basically, the way the legislation was written for the app stores was it's something like a $5,000 penalty per user per day. Now, if you try to figure out like how many, the 100 million TikTok users in the United States, and you think of per user per day times 5,000, you could see why a company like Apple, the biggest company in the world, basically said, yeah, it's not in the App Store until the law is repealed. Like, we don't care what the president says. There's a law on the books from Congress. No, no guarantee will get us to put it back in the App Store. The law needs to be changed.
I just went and looked in the Google Play Store,
Yeah.
and there are two funny things about what I found when I searched for TikTok. The first entry,
Yeah.
the sponsored entry,
Yeah.
is for Red Note.
Okay.
One of
Yeah.
the
Yeah.
another Chinese, right,
Sure. Yeah.
sourced
Yeah. The
equivalent
yeah.
that I think had a spate of popularity, but now it's just
Yeah.
not since TikTok's back.
Oh, sure.
Anyway, the official wording here, looking for TikTok, downloads for this app are paused due to current US legal requirements.
Yep. Yeah,
That's it.
so, and I've heard like legal people say, look, there could be all these guarantees coming from the White House, but the next administration could always look back and say, hey, there was a law on the books, you owe this money. Apple and Google are now funding the US government for the next several years because you owe us trillions of dollars. Like, literally, like, we own those companies now. So I could see why Apple's saying, no, absolutely not. It's just not in the App Store until the
Too
laws change.
risky. Yep.
So, that being the case, the app that all of the US users are using for TikTok is the update that came out like a week before, the initial 14-hour ban. And that app is growing older by the minute. No way to update it at all.
So two things. One, I don't know. It wouldn't surprise me if on the Android side there was an APK that could be
Sure,
sideloaded.
sideloading, but that's not a mass thing.
It's not a bad way. When you think about it, desperate TikTok users could take
Sure.
desperate measures,
It
right?
won't be, the numbers won't be there though. Yeah.
And Apple, I was just reading this morning that Apple was forced to allow other app stores in the EU.
In the EU, yes.
And the reason it came up is because some of those app stores are allowing porn
Yeah.
in, where the Apple App Store does not. It's absolutely hard code. But the theory then is, of course, that TikTok could come in through one of those other app stores. At any rate, I thought it was interesting that's happening.
Yeah, it is. And that was an interesting case that you just brought up. So the EU said Apple's got a monopoly on the App Store. They have to allow third-party app stores. And so they made it that Apple had to do it. So Apple came up with a system where you can download an app that's a third-party app store, and they have no say what goes on there. And one of the things Apple warned about was, well, we have strict rules against things like porn. And there are no porn apps in the app, the iPhone App Store. And but if we do this, we don't have that control anymore. And this is the first instance of a third-party app store that let an adult app in. And Apple now, because I think there was a lot of other people saying, oh, you're blowing that out of proportion. And Apple's pointing back and saying, look, now, there you go.
We told you so.
We told you so that this
Yep.
would happen. And now we can, they might. I mean, I'm sure Apple is always looking to figure out how they could push back on the regulations the EU is throwing at them. So this is, something that I'm sure they'll be using in some way to say, hey, this is one of the things, one of the reasons we didn't want this to happen. So anyway, there's that. So that's kind of
It's
interesting.
interesting though, because the other side of that coin is that I think that some parts of the EU are, I'll just say, more liberal with
Yeah,
respect to that kind of
sure.
content. So they may not even perceive it as an issue. They may
No.
perceive it as a good thing that
Could
that
be.
EU users have the freedom to do something that they've been restricted to doing
It
in the
could be.
past.
But I mean, soon enough, there'll be reports of children with the
Of
app,
course. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
and that kind of thing. And then there'll be reports of like, well, Apple's violating our laws because they're allowing a adult app on the iPhone, and then Apple's
Right.
saying, but we're going with your law
Your laws are in
to
conflict.
allow
Yes.
yeah, so to tell us what we should we be taking more control, or what do you want us to do? So yeah, anyway.
So, along those lines, I guess, one of the things that I have been thinking about of late is Signal, the instant messaging communications app called Signal.
Yes.
There was an article recently. I'll look it up and include the link in the show notes. I came across it for Seven Takeaways and threw it in there. It's an article that basically says, Signal for government employees. Because in the United States right now, things are a little bit tumultuous,
Yes, to say the
certainly at the
least.
federal level.
Yeah.
And there are individuals who are trying to get information out who could get in trouble for getting information out and so forth. So a lot of people are pointing at Signal as a safe way to do that. And I started to think about that. And I'm not naturally a paranoid person. I just am not. In fact, one of the statements that I've made frequently on Ask Leo is that you and I simply aren't that interesting when it comes to things like, people, companies scanning your documents that you stored in the cloud or any of those kinds of things that people tend to react against. It's not to say that there aren't some interesting people, but in general, you and I aren't those people. It's not something I worry about. However, I hate to say it. One of the exceptions that I would always make, of course, is that unless you are living in a repressive or an authoritarian regime. Now, I'm certainly not saying we're living in such a regime. I'm not even saying we're necessarily, obviously, heading in that direction. But there are concerns. And as such, I just thought it made sense to take the steps now to move some of my personal communications are moving over to Signal. And basically, I've got an article coming out in a couple of weeks on Ask Leo to talk about Signal and why I'm moving to it. And it's something that I think people should at least be thinking about. Because when you think about the alternatives, WhatsApp is like the most popular one in the world right now, not necessarily in the United States, but around the world, owned by Facebook. Facebook Instant Messenger is another one that's extremely popular simply because it's just there.
Yeah.
If you're in Facebook, it's just there. But it's still Facebook / Meta / Zuckerberg. Even Telegram, who is making, I think, a valiant effort to do the right thing when it comes to security and privacy and so forth, for a variety of reasons, not the least of which was the head of Telegram getting jailed in France for some period of time. They are now responding to subpoenas and providing information that they apparently do have. I don't know how much they have. I suspect it's not things like your conversations, but it could be like much of the metadata associated with what you're doing. And the same thing is true for like SMS and RCS, your telephone companies, Apple, Google, Microsoft. I mean, how much do you really trust all of them now? And how much do you trust them to resist, a potentially more forceful government request? So, Signal, one of the things I actually love about it, is they just don't have that information. They can't give that information because it's not something they keep.
That's the way to do it, right? Just don't have it in the first place.
Exactly. So they actually publish the subpoenas that they get, which is a surprisingly small number, since apparently the law enforcement folks have cottoned onto the fact that there's nothing to be had. But it's amazing how little information they keep or even need to provide their service. Everything you do, chats, voice, video, attachments, etc., it's all encrypted end to end, period. It's just not accessible to anybody in between. And I just think that more and more, that should be something that people should be considering. We've been talking about it for a long time for folks in other countries. We talk about it a lot for reporters who are embedded in some of these other countries like North Korea, Iran, and other places. But now it seems like it might have slightly broader applicability depending on how things end up going here. So I just wanted to point out Signal as being an option, an important option, a good option. And honestly, there's no downside to using it. The biggest obstacle to using Signal is getting all your friends to use Signal, right? Because having a messaging program that you use regularly and that you're comfortable with, that's a barrier. But very slowly, it's probably time to at least start raising the flag.
Yeah, and I actually have heard, so I've also saw a mention of Signal recently because there are a lot of upcoming, protests coming up in U.S. cities.
Yes.
And I happened to see something interesting, when I was just reading through the local stuff on Reddit, and somebody was talking about, the protests coming up, and somebody mentioned, remember to leave your mobile phone at home. And I thought, well, wait a minute. Hold, why? So then I went and I started reading about it, and then people started discussing it. So the idea is leave your mobile phone at home so you can't be tracked. They can't prove that you were there at the protest and all of that. And which is certainly the case. I mean, remember the one area of privacy that everybody forgets about, we've talked about it on this show a lot, is the whole thing that the mobile phone companies have our location through their towers, and it's easily accessible to law enforcement, right? It's like no matter how private, if you're using Signal or whatever, it doesn't matter. People, they know where you are, right? If you have, so the idea of leaving your mobile phone at home, that's if you don't want to be tracked, it's a good idea. Except, of course, you want to bring your mobile phone because it's the way to coordinate things, it's the way to find out things, it's the way to take pictures, which of course is the opposite of like what they're saying. They're saying just like pretend, be a ghost. Go to the protest, but you weren't at the protest, right? And I'm thinking, well, I'm thinking of like the civil rights marches and the Vietnam War protests. Like I've read, books by like Abbie Hoffman was like a famous, protester back. And a part of the whole point was to show you were there to the point of getting arrested as part of it. Even recently, like Greta Thunberg, right? Some of her things was to protest until she was arrested, right? And so to be ultra on the record, like I'm putting my body on the line here. I will be arrested. I will sign my name in the book, take pictures of me as I'm being arrested for what I believe in. So it was weird to hear people saying that, like, they don't want to in any way be known as being at the protests, whereas there are other people that I would imagine would still follow the rule of, like, I very much want to, that's why I'm going. To put myself out there to protest, whatever that particular march is about or particular event is about. So it's a weird thing. And it was like I could see the privacy advocates
I
looking at these
wonder.
protests and being like, leave your cell phone at home. It's the only way to protect your privacy. And then me being like, wait, what about the people who go with their cell phone, take a picture and post it on Instagram? Because they want to, right? They're like, this is my Instagram feed. I am here supporting this cause or against this thing. And, it's a weird dichotomy.
I wonder though if the privacy advocates are trying to appeal to a group of people that would not normally show up. There are going to be people
Maybe.
that show up
Sure.
and put their names in front, like you say. But a lot of what I think a lot of what they want out of these protests is not just individual recognition or making a statement as a person, but also the size of the crowd, right? The size of the crowd. The bigger the crowd, the better. If 10% of those people are willing to be identified, fantastic. If those other 90% show up because they won't be identified, that gets them a bigger crowd.
I think that's a good point, and I think that's what should have been talked about right up front, was like you should first decide if you're going to go. Do you want to maintain your anonymity and have no record at all that you were there? If so, here's all these things you need to do. And if not, right, because there is really no gray area, in it. If you're taking your cell phone with you, then somebody will be able to find out you were there. Matter of fact, you could say if you have no mask on your face, covering a portion of your face, there are going to be other people taking pictures and all that. If not, if you do want to put yourself out there, like most of the people in the past have done with all protests, then maybe actually give you advice the opposite direction. Do post to Instagram to so your friends can see that,
And
yes,
here, use these
you're
hashtags,
there.
use this, use
Use
that.
it. Hashtags and maybe you posting to Instagram and this march could mean that next month there's another march and you'll find that five of your friends come with you. Because of that post you made, and now they say, "Boy, I didn't know that you went to that. Tell me about it. How was it? I'll come with you." That kind of thing. So you have to decide which side you're on. And if you are on the side that you want privacy, then yes, there are a ton of things you need to do. But if you're not, then there's probably a ton of things you should do the other way. So, or you could also go with the, I don't want it to, I just want to go just to experience it. I don't need to post it everywhere. Or whatever, and that's fine too. Anyway, so interesting. Private. I did not expect to see people talking about privacy in something that I thought was completely like the whole point was not to be
Whole
private.
point
But
was
there you
to
go.
yes.
Anyway,
All righty, I have a complaint this week.
Yes.
I have a get off my lawn. Microsoft, God bless them, they have become more and more insistent about some of their features. They've been pushing OneDrive like nobody's business for the past couple of years. And of recent, they have been pushing Copilot, their AI offering. And to the point where, I mean, I don't know if you don't see it on your Mac, but we've got an AI
I hear
Copilot
about it.
app that shows up in Windows.
Yeah.
And, it's in the Edge browser and it's in a few other places. The recent change is that they have changed the subscription model for what used to be Microsoft Office 365, which was then Microsoft 365 and is now Microsoft 365 Copilot, their subscription for the Microsoft Office suite of apps, among other things. It now includes Copilot in the apps, whether you want them or not. And whether you want them or not, the price has increased by, I think, 25% to, I don't know if they're using Copilot as an excuse to raise the price or if they were going to raise the price anyway or whatever. But the point is, Copilot is there whether you want it or not. And most people that I talk to don't want it. My position on a lot of these features that, and I know other companies push features all the time. Microsoft has been particularly egregious in some of the ways that they've been doing it over the past few years. Like I said, OneDrive and Copilot are especially sore points. If you want people to use a feature, if you want people to actually have it and use it, make it compelling enough that it's their choice, that they would want to use it. Don't put it in their face and have them have to opt out somehow, usually through some kind of a hack. Make the feature good enough that it's wanted. If it's not good enough, if you have to push it on people, then yeah, it's probably not that great a feature and you should be rethinking what it is you're delivering. Anyway, that's just me. I'm grumping on behalf of a lot of my readers because it's a complaint that I've been getting a lot lately. And I've got a couple of articles coming up on not necessarily how to get rid of Copilot in Office, but at least how to disable it and get it out of your face.
Yeah, it's kind of a similar thing with Apple Intelligence, where a lot of Apple Intelligence stuff, you can turn off individual features, but you have a big off switch for Apple Intelligence in general, right? So, and with the latest version, the default is on now. So you have to go in and turn it off. But it is
Oh,
easy to
wow.
turn it off. One switch and it's off. But the complaint is that because it's there's part of a large language model is on your device, iPhone, iPad, or Mac. That's there whether you turn it off or not. So it's a few gigs of stuff taken up. And so you've got, and I always warn people, don't buy the Mac with the tiny drive. Don't get that minimum. Like, please,
You'll
like I tell people,
want
that's for
it.
like if it's a school classroom and it's like gonna be, they're gonna have nothing on it. Don't ever get, oh, I'm gonna get the minimum one. I don't need anything or whatever. It's like,
You'll be
oh, so
sorry.
now it's another little chunk that's like taken up, and it's like you can't. And hopefully in the future they do have a way to uninstall, or if by turning it off it uninstalls. But yeah, that's kind of my grumpy complaint there.
I'm glad that you've got a way to just turn it off. I haven't even looked at things like disk space for things like Copilot because, if we were to get to that point, of it being a disk space problem only, I'd be happy.
So on to Ain't It Cool. I want to start off by repeating one that I know you had at some point. And I think you mentioned it at some point. So this is Star Trek Lower Decks, the animated series that is now over, but it was 5 seasons. And at some point you mentioned it and you're like, have you watched it? I thought, I think I watched one episode. Maybe I'll check it out again. So I did check it out again and I watched another episode and started binging it. And I love it. I absolutely love it. Great characters. And I love how they could, it does three things at once. It is Star Trek. It's real adventures of characters in Star Trek for this series. It is an homage to Star Trek because they're constantly talking about it, even to the point where I can't remember what it is, but they make up fans refer to the original series as TOS, the Star Trek, the original series. They came up with an acronym. It's TOS. It doesn't say the original series because that wouldn't make any sense. But that when they refer to Kirk and Spock and all that, they say TOS and it means something else. But it's like very tongue in cheek. So, so they're constantly talking about the adventures of Voyager and Next Generation and the Enterprise and Deep Space Nine and all that. It's great. And it's also making fun of Star Trek.
Yes.
Constantly, another cave. So nothing's something bad happens every time Starfleet beams some people into caves. Now, what are you talking about? I mean, the last 10 or so times, yes, but this time I'm sure it's fine. You know, I mean, it's like constantly just making fun of the different things with Star Trek. So it's just a joy to watch. And I'm sad that it's only, I have a few episodes left of the fifth season. I'm crawling through the fifth season slowly. And I'm so sad that it only five seasons, but at least it was five seasons. It's
Are you, have you watched Strange New World?
No, not there yet. We are in the 90s as far as like watching everything chronologically. I mean, I'm jumping the gun with Lower Decks, but yeah.
When you get to Strange New Worlds, there is a crossover episode between Strange New Worlds and Lower Decks.
Lower Decks, yeah.
They, two of the characters, the primary characters from Lower Decks, the actors, the voice actors actually show up as actors in, Strange New Worlds. There's some fun animation later on in the show, but they actually, they do an, it's an interesting Star Trek plausible crossover. What cracked me up was just like a throwaway line.
Yeah.
Because there's a difference in animation and live action.
Mm-hmm.
That you don't necessarily pay attention to. And all of a sudden, one of the Lower Decks characters says to the other, "Why does everybody talk so slow?" When you think about it, animated characters, especially on Lower Decks, they talk much faster than normal people do, right? It's a characteristic of animation, I guess. But again, it's self-referential. I thought it was hilarious when it came out.
Yeah, and of course, there's plenty of characters from the live-action Star Trek series that make appearances in as animated characters with the real voices, in Lower Decks, and usually making fun of themselves and an homage to themselves at the same time. Some of the episodes are just so brilliant. It's great. Cool.
So mine, a completely different Zen change here. The show we've recently gotten hooked on is something called The Pit. It is a hospital drama, emergency room drama. It stars, of all things, Noah Wiley. And you may remember Noah Wiley as one of the stars of ER. This is not ER. This is significantly grittier. Significantly, I would say, more realistic. Realize that my wife is a former nurse, so we're both in that situation where there are different kinds of shows where we point at things and say, that's not the way they'd really do it. That's not the way they really do it. I do it with computers. She does it with medical stuff. That's not happening here. There's some really, really interesting storylines, some tension, some really good stuff. Wiley is great as a dramatic actor in this show. Anyway, just enjoying it. It's on Max. It's ongoing, and we enjoy it. The Pit.
Awesome. Cool. All right.
So to promote something of my own, this is an article that I probably end up updating of late every 6 to 8 months or so, because the answer, well, it didn't change and it didn't change, but it is starting to change. And that's because the article is, should I update to Windows 11? I'm pointing at the January 2025 update. It's askleo.com/135037. Basically, the answer is starting to change because the deadline or end of support for Windows 10 is coming up in October. So for the longest time, I've been saying, there's no rush, no reason. It's not that compelling. And while that part of it hasn't really changed that much, The fact is, the deadline is arriving. The deadline is showing up. And it is something that I think more and more people ought to be considering now while they have the 6, 8 months, whatever it is, before the deadline shows up to experiment and to decide exactly where they want to go. So, should I update to Windows 11?
Cool. And I'll link to the video that I'm doing on the Apple Invite
Oh, good.
app and everything, which actually, well, it'll be out by the time this is posted, that will be posted as well.
Okay.
So.
Yeah, it's funny, my article on Signal, for example, that's a couple of weeks out. So I'm just sort of teasing it.
Teasing. Okay, cool.
All righty. Well, I think that actually does us once again for another week. Hopefully I'll be healthy again next week. We'll see how it goes. Hopefully I haven't been too sniffly. I don't think I've coughed too much today. Again, as always, thank you everyone for listening to us ramble, and we will see you here again real soon. Take care, everyone. Bye-bye.
Bye.
The show notes for this week are at tehpodcast.com/teh240. If you have a comment or question for us, be sure to leave it on the show notes page. The TEH podcast is hosted by Leo Notenboom of AskLeo.com and Gary Rosenzweig of MacMost.com and edited by Connie Delaney. I'm your synthetic announcer, Adam, from 11labs.com.